I mean, a pivotal, seminal moment for me in my life was when my friend Mary was living with me, and we came home one night from a dinner party, and she was completely unprepared for this, but I sat down on the couch and out of nowhere started sobbing. And she said, "What's the matter?" And I said, "What's the matter is drinks and dinner. My whole life is going to be drinks and dinner. I'm going to be like Hickey in The Iceman Cometh. I'm just going to have pipe dreams and I'm not going to fulfill them."
It's Shelf Life. Sex, drugs, and opera are on the agenda in this episode of the show with the acclaimed composer Ricky Ian Gordon, best known for his operatic version of The Grapes of Wrath. He talks about his passion for music, his sexual obsessions, and how poetry, music, and art can be a balm for life. Stay with us.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. President Trump says Iran has no choice but to reach an agreement with the U.S. to end the war. He said the Iranian leaders had dealt with weak U.S. leaders in the past, but now he says Iran is virtually incapacitated.
They're proud. There are things they never thought they'd be doing that they're going to have to do. They've got no choice. And it takes a little while. You know, you're talking about 47 years of getting away with whatever they wanted. I mean, this should have been done long ago.
President Trump was interviewed Friday by NBC. It was broadcast today on Meet the Press. Investors will get a look into both inflation and the housing market this week. NPR Stephen Bisaha reports home sales have been dragging.
Historically, spring is a hot time for home sales, but the market's cooled in recent years due to high mortgage rates. Tuesday, the National Association of Realtors will report May's existing home sales. Zillow's already reported sales down nearly 3% from a year earlier. On Wednesday, the Labor Department will share the latest on consumer prices. In April, prices rose 3.8% year over year, much faster than the Federal Reserve would like. If this week gives us similar inflation numbers for May, that would increase pressure on the Fed to raise interest rates this year, especially after a strong jobs report showed May added 172,000 jobs in a still resilient labor market. Stephen Bisaha, NPR News.
Voters in Peru are heading to the polls today to elect a new president. Recent surveys indicate most people are deeply unhappy with the stark far-left versus far-right choice. Simeon Tagle has more from Lima.
For the third time in the last four elections, Peruvians face a polarizing choice of presidential candidates. Far-right candidate Keiko Fujimori or a far-left opponent, Roberto Sanchez. The election comes after years of political chaos, runaway corruption, and rising street crime. Many voters blame the outgoing scandal-racked Congress, dominated by Keiko's Popular Force Party. She is promising to build maximum security prisons and send the army into the streets. Sanchez, a member of that Congress, plans to nationalize large chunks of the economy and curb imports. The tightly contested election is expected to be decided by the unusually high number of undecided voters who are dissatisfied with both candidates. For NPR News, I'm Simeon Tagle in Lima, Peru.
Kosovo is holding another parliamentary election today, the third in 18 months. The political parties have failed to agree on a new president. Kosovo is one of the poorest nations in Europe and wants to join the European Union, but has had no functioning government much of the past year. Analysts predict the governing party will collect the most votes, but would need to reach agreement then with opposition parties. This is NPR News in Washington. The Nigerian army said today it's freed 360 people who had been abducted by the militant group Boko Haram. They included men, women, and children from various communities. An army spokesman said two babies had died before they could be rescued. The Tony Awards will be held at Radio City Music Hall in New York City tonight. Musical and play revivals have gotten the biggest buzz this season, but Jeff London reports the prize for Best Musical has the most effect on the box office.
Will it be an adaptation of the teenage vampire movie The Lost Boys? When the or the Titanic parody Titanic? Two-person show, Two Strangers Carry a Cake Across New York.
New York!
Or the Golden Age musical parody, Schmigadoon.
Shake our tune.
All four will be performing on the Tonys broadcast, and all four could use the box office boost. All but Two Strangers have announced national tours. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
The mullet haircut, short in the front, long in the back, is having a moment. The 2026 Mullet Championship was held yesterday in Copenhagen. More than 1,000 people came to watch. 12 contestants were judged on their cut's style, uniqueness, and overall performance. Judge Bobby Agren, who owns two hair salons, says he likes the finesse, the twist, the nostalgia, maybe ugly in a beautiful way. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Raymond James, where wealth management, banking, and capital markets strategies start with connections between people. Raymond James, the power of personal. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. This is NPR.
I mean, a pivotal, seminal moment for me in my life was when my friend Mary was living with me and we came home one night from a dinner party. And she was completely unprepared for this, but I sat down on the couch and out of nowhere started sobbing. And she said, "What's the matter?" And I said, "What's the matter is drinks and dinner. My whole life is going to be drinks and dinner. I'm going to be like Hickey in The Iceman Cometh. I'm just going to have pipe dreams and I'm not going to fulfill them."
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. Hello, a teenage prodigy who worshipped the movies of Ingmar Bergman and the poetry of Sylvia Plath, Ricky Ian Gordon has made a career turning novels and poems into operas and song. I was that kid who was invited to the party because I could play anything, no matter how hard, and incite everyone into singing all night, he writes in his new memoir, Seeing Through, a chronicle of sex, drugs, and opera. But that exuberant talent has an undercurrent of pain and sadness that has shaped and coloured his life and career. It's there in his opera of John Steinbeck's Depression-era novel, The Grapes of Wrath, as well as his musical interpretations of poems by Langston Hughes, E.E. Cummings, Emily Dickinson, and the contemporary poet Marie Howe, whose poem, What the Living Do, Ricky Ian Gordon has chosen to discuss today. Ricky, so good to see you on the other side of the camera there. Welcome to Shelf Life.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here, Aaron. Thanks for having me.
You've got a big smile, your trademark hat, and I think you're at home in Wolf Lake, which is in Sullivan County, not too far from where I am, actually. Yeah. So we're practically neighbors. I've just come off a binge of your book, Seeing Through. It's 450 pages long and never once sags. It's an astonishing feat of candor and sometimes also of piercing insight to what it is to be human. Mm. At one point you write, "Will this book be an act of willful self-destruction, satisfying, even cathartic to write, but a hand grenade to all that I have built?" Well, Ricky, the reviews are in. They're uniformly excellent. Has that put your concerns to rest?
In some ways, Aaron, it's I had a moment coming out of the quarantine, my very first New York performance. I was at the Metropolitan Opera with Kevin, my partner, and I saw Heidi Wailson, the critic from the Wall Street Journal, walking down the aisle. And I thought, oh my God, the things these people are going to know about me. Do you know what I mean? But now that it is all over, I actually feel empowered by those people knowing those things about me. I feel like it widens my soul. It's like they have a much more complete picture of me. Now when they deride me or revere me, it is with a fuller knowledge of who I am. And I feel known, Aaron, in a way I've never felt known. And it's a good feeling. I teach singers, I teach composers, and the words I always use when I teach are danger and necessity. And finally, in a very clear way, I have demonstrated both of those words in my own work. I feel this book was dangerous to write, and I feel like it was necessary to write. And both of those things feel inarguable to me.
Yeah, I mean, the memoir is subtitled A Chronicle of Sex, Drugs, and Opera, and you don't hold back on any of those three. Uh-uh. There's a lot of sex in this book and a lot of really frank insight to your evolution, and that includes your experimentation with drugs. It's pretty remarkable. You say at one point, I have sat through countless meals where deadly secrets were eating at my brain like bees, making it impossible to communicate. I have been smothered by my insecurities. All during the meal, I've imagined, how can I get you into bed? If all the people I had sat across the table from knew how often I feel terrible about myself, how alienated in their company, they would be shocked. Well, none of them can not know that now. You've taken us right into that deeply private space of the inner life, and in a sense of the inner shrink, because you do a lot of self-analysis in this book. You began it as part of a writer's group that you instigated during COVID when you were staying upstate in Wolf Lake. When did you know that if you were to publish this memoir, indeed to write this memoir, it was going to be this ruthlessly frank?
Well, when I started the writing group, which was really in response to all of my musical work, all of my operas being postponed. I mean, I was deep into rehearsing an opera that was commissioned by the Metropolitan Opera and the Lincoln Center Theater. We were going to open on March 23rd, and on March 12th, every theater in New York closed down. The Grapes of Wrath, which Renee Fleming and Patrick Summers were going to produce at Aspen, was postponed. It was like my whole work life fell apart. And when Kevin and I came upstate with our little doggie Lucy, I was like, I need to do something else, you know? So I talked to Marie Howe and my friend Michael Klein, because we had already started a check-in group. We would all meet once a week and just check in, like, how are you during this totally weird time? And then I just thought, I want to start a writing group. See what happens if I just focus on that part of my brain for a little while, you know? And then really what happened, Aaron, was I at least felt at the time, there's no way I can compete with this group of writers as like a stylist or a sentence constructor. And of course, everything about me, I want to be loved. Do you know what I mean? So how can I be loved in this group? Well, my experiment was, I will see how deeply I could allow myself to be known. And it was not about being outrageous, but what would it be like to tell the secret stories, to say the things I've never said? I'm not even to a therapist. And you have to remember, Aaron, I never was thinking it would be published. I was just doing it. So meanwhile, if I back up, I had met Jonathan Galassi at the Pulitzer dinner, which was at La Bernardine. And Jonathan and his husband, Tinoch, and I were getting along famously.
We should just say here that Jonathan Galassi is a famous publisher for R. Strauss Giroux. He's also a published poet himself. So you really had an extraordinary connection right there.
He was Robert Gottlieb's editor. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, so really what I did was I sent him some chapters and I said, you don't even have to read this, but at least I will say this. I doubt you will read another composer memoir that's like this. And he wrote me back this great letter. And he just said, there's something here, definitely. And I would just keep going. Don't look back. Don't edit. Just keep accruing material and see what kind of shape it takes. And about 2 weeks later, I sent him two more sections. He wrote back right away and said, well, I've read everything you've sent me, and I want to work with you on this book. Do you have a literary agent? Can we talk in the morning? And I just ran upstairs and screamed. And, you know, I would have paid them to publish the book, but I got a nice advance, and I could go off unemployment. And it was all blessed.
Keep writing and don't look back. Great advice there from Jonathan Galassi. At one point in your prologue for this book, you write, "What has been keeping me alive?" And then you answer it, music. It has been, you say, the cause of most of the joy in your life, as well as most of the unhappiness. Music was an incredibly early discovery for you. At the age of 5, you heard your sister, Lorraine, practicing a sonatina and immediately sat down and played the same piece by ear. I'd love you to tell me about that discovery. You grew up on Harbour Isle on Long Island, the only son of parents who anglicized their Jewish name from Goldenberg to Gordon.
Well, first, there are moments when you walk into a light, and in that light, there is an order that is unfamiliar to you, but it suddenly feels like a lantern in the dark, you know? And there are two things that it was when my sister Susan first started putting me to bed at night by reading poetry to me, by reading Edna Savitz and Millay, and it was music, just... There was Lorraine playing that Clementi sonatina, and I had my piano lessons, but there's something I describe in the book where one day my mother took me to my piano lesson, and I walked into Mrs. Fox's house, she was the piano teacher, and I heard these crunchy chords happening, and I can feel it now. It's like there was something about the sound of that music that felt like that defines what I want my life to be about. And it's like, if you look at my life is about music and poetry. And so I do feel at this point like God has been guiding me. And I'm going to call it God, which makes some people uncomfortable, but I've lived long enough to earn God. You know what I mean? And as you know, I had a precarious relationship with religion. But now I just feel like, you know, they say in AA, after the first miracle, it's vulgar to doubt. Well, if I look at my life, it's one miracle after another. And who has been guiding this human being I call Ricky? So I feel very much like everything I have made, even with the trail of destruction that it took to get here, I lived. It makes me think of Anne Sexton, that fantastic book, Live or Die, you know, live or die, but don't poison everything. So I didn't poison everything. I lived and I made some beauty and I said some clear things about myself that hopefully resonate with other people. And I was one of the lucky ones that found the things that defined my life enough to make me not want to die. Because, Aaron, I say it in the book, I wasn't afraid when I finally gave up drinking and drugs. I was not afraid of dying. I was afraid of dying while I was alive. I was afraid of not fulfilling what I knew was my dream. I mean, a pivotal, seminal moment for me in my life was when my friend Mary was living with me and we came home one night from a dinner party. And she was completely unprepared for this, but I sat down on the couch and out of nowhere started sobbing. And she said, "What's the matter?" And I said, "What's the matter is drinks and dinner. My whole life is going to be drinks and dinner. I'm going to be like Hickey in The Iceman Cometh. I'm just going to have pipe dreams and I'm not going to fulfill them." And I knew it.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and I'm talking with the opera writer and now memoirist, Ricky Ian Gordon. His book, Seeing Through: A Chronicle of Sex, Drugs, and Opera, has just been published. Ricky, just even hearing you talk about going into your music teacher's house and hearing those crunchy chords was your description. Mm-hmm. I don't think at that age I could have remotely had that kind of affinity for music. Do you think it was innate, just there from birth for you, or was it rooted in something else?
Well, I think it's both. You know, my mother, before I was born, was a big Borscht Belt singer-comedian, right? Speaking of the Catskill Mountains. And she was extraordinarily talented. And what I mean when I say that was when my mother sang, something very deep came through. And it was stirring enough to create some kind of inner life in me that seemed worthy of aspiring to. I will be honest with you, Aaron. I always feel like I've lived before. When I was little, I used to talk about reincarnation. And the only reason I say that is because some things feel so familiar to me. But I also really respect and admire the mystery. I do not pretend to have any answers. But there are things like this thing with Victor Book of Opera, or...
Well, let's just fill in for the audience. So this was a book of opera. And among opera fanatics and opera fans, it's a pretty iconic book.
Yes, yes, it was the story of hundreds of operas. And for each opera, there was a picture, a photograph from the Metropolitan Opera of a production of it. And I was at my friend Peter's piano lesson. And while I was listening, I pulled this book out from the shelf. And I literally remember it as a moment when there was smoke and light behind the book. By the time his piano lesson was over, I was so obsessed with that book. Mrs. Fox just gave it to me. She just said, take it. And that was it. Peter and I, who's still my best friend and a year older than me, became obsessed with opera. We started going every Saturday into the city. We'd wait online for standing room tickets. We'd sit all the way up in family circle at the Met. We'd be on Franco Corelli, Birgit Nilsson, Beverly Sills's. We'd be on everyone's waiting lists and go backstage to meet them. And we were children. You know what I mean? Where does that come from? It's just like, I don't know, Aaron, it's like God plucked us from somewhere. And when I wrote that opera about Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas, 27, which was about them at the Salon at 27 Rue de Fleurus. When I started reading about Gertrude Stein, it was like, I've been here. I know this world. And because of that, she created another scaffold for me. I saw what I wanted my life to look like not just the composer, not just the poet, but the artist surrounded by artists, surrounded by literature, surrounded by depth, surrounded by poetry, surrounded by meaning. That is the world I wanted to live in. And so I made it with Gertrude Stein and that Salon as a model of what I wanted my life to look like.
Part of that model involved a lot of poetry. You've been a fan of poetry all your life. As you say there, your sister Susan, who went to Vassar, used to recite Edna St. Vincent Millay to you at night. She would essentially read you to sleep. You compared it in the book to having gold coins dropped into your lap, changing you forever. Why do you think poetry has been such a particular influence on your work as a composer?
Well, first of all, I worshipped my sisters, and my sister Susan was the oldest, and she was frighteningly brilliant. So we're talking about a really brilliant, high charisma individual sitting on my bed when I'm a little boy. And I remember the first poem she read to me was Edna St. Vincent Millay's The Ballad of the Harp Weaver, which begins, "Son said my mother, when I was knee high, you've need of clothes to cover you, and not rag have I. There's nothing in the house to make a boy breeches, not shears to cut a cloth with, not thread to take stitches. There's nothing in the house but a loaf end of rye and a harp with a woman's head nobody will buy." And she began to cry. And at the end of that poem, the boy wakes up, his mother is dead, her hands are frozen to the harp, and she has woven him a wardrobe that is made out of gold thread. So the gold coins relate to that poem and the golden thread. I was so obsessed with that poem, which is why I know it, you know, by heart now. And there's something about sadness, poverty, love, need, pain, productivity. I can't think of them separately. It's like art is pain, art is sadness, art is beauty. They're all one to me. During the quarantine, I had written Kevin a poem called Virgin Snow. And all of a sudden this morning, I realized, oh, I need to add something in that poem, because since I wrote that poem, Lucy, our dog, died, and it was devastating for me. And I added four lines about Lucy And now that poem is done, even though I wrote it 2 years ago. I guess the thing is, Aaron, the gift is that music, poetry, they're containers to house grief, to house love, to house obsession, to house sex, to house drugs. It's where I house all those things about myself, which is why it's agony when, you know, people don't like it, because you feel like, well, then they don't like me.
Hmm. You write of your family, we were difficult, but not always in a good way. Often we were terribly sad. Can you explain that sadness?
Yes. In the book, I first bring it up because I'm a little boy and I'm standing in my driveway, and there's the driveway, and then there's the stoop, and then my sister's standing above me, my sister Susan, and she's getting ready to go. She's a cashier at Wallbounds, which was a chain of grocery stores. And I saw something in her face that upset me. On the other hand, she was also ennobled because she was standing there in the sun. And so I didn't know what I was looking at, but I knew it was something big. And then as life went on, I saw that Sheila, for example, the youngest of my sisters, even though people made fun of her and called her the teen queen or the Leslie Gore of Long Island, Sheila would lock herself in her room for days in profound despair. She was way beyond a teen queen. She had a darkness in her. And then my sister Lorraine, she went from being this wild feminist singing songs with this band called Goldflower to Lorraine eventually, the same way a plant grows towards the sun, Lorraine grew towards terror. By the end of her life, she was agoraphobic. She was afraid of everything. But we all had enormous things to overcome. My father, he was a rage-filled, intense machine that never got to run properly. At any other time, my father would have been brilliant. He would have had an education. He had all this treasure in him, but he had to go to war. He had to feed his family during the Depression. So he was thwarted on so many levels, and it turned into dangerous rage. He definitely could have killed someone. And then my mother was this unbelievably gifted singer, comedian, personality, but she gave it all up to be a mother and a housewife. And neither of them were free of resentment about how their lives turned out. And so I think on some level, we all my siblings, felt that despair and frustration projected on us and didn't know what to do with it. And, you know, Susan and Lorraine died. Me and Sheila are still here. But it's been a really a journey of exaltation and catastrophe.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking with Ricky Ian Gordon, a composer of many operas, including, among others, The Grapes of Wrath. Ricky, as a 12-year-old, you traveled to New York City unaccompanied with your friend Peter. He's 13. Mm-hmm. Quite hard to imagine parents letting their kids do that today. And you emerge on 42nd Street, and instead of the Broadway you're anticipating, you find peep shows and hustlers and prostitutes. It's the first time you're really confronted in shop windows with naked men. And that does something to you, right?
So here we are. We're on 42nd Street, and basically one window after another. On the left is women and on the right is men, and all of their genitals are slightly covered with black tape. And Peter and I are trembling, looking at these images, and we couldn't possibly say it to each other, but neither of us were looking on the left. For the rest of the day, did we go to seek out the Metropolitan Opera or Lincoln Center or Broadway? No, we darted in and out of pornography stores where everyone had a sign that said, be 21 or be gone. And we would somehow, like mice, manage to scamper in just enough to see a penis and then be chased out of the store. And in the train on the way home, we were, I'm sure, visibly shaken because we didn't know how to talk about it. So we didn't.
Ricky, one of the most powerful parts of this book is the recital of deaths during the 80s at the height of the AIDS pandemic. You're in your 20s when your friends started getting sick, and your chapter is just devastating. It's a kind of roll call of the beautiful and talented young men ripped from the world of the living. Once drugs do make it possible to survive, you say, we didn't have to rebuild our lives. We had to build new ones. The greatest loss in your life is your partner, Jeffrey. He's a Shirley Bassey, loving, part Colombian, part Italian man you fall deeply in love with, but who tells you on your first date that he's HIV positive. In that sense, your relationship was always on borrowed time, and his death inspires some incredible works by you. That relationship seems still to be a kind of guiding star for you and the way you think about yourself and the world. I wonder if you can talk a little about Jeffrey and his appearance in your life.
Jeffrey cracked me open. I was someone different before I met him. And what changed about me was not just that I fell in love with him and that I said yes to a kind of service I never could have been capable of without being sober. And contextually, through the entire AIDS crisis, I worked at the Gay Men's Health Crisis. Everything you did was about a memorial service, or your life was death riddled. But then when I fell in love with Jeffrey, I did not at all expect that that's where that was going to go. My first date with Jeffrey was on a Sunday. The Thursday previous, my friend Mary Rogers, Mary Gettle, Richard Rogers' daughter, took me to the theater to see Paul Rudnick's play, Jeffrey. And in the play, he sort of says that AIDS is like the person at the party you wish would leave because they're making everybody tense and upset, but they're at the party, you know? And that was how it was coming to feel like. And then Jeffrey said he was HIV positive, and something switched in my head. And I just thought, well, then I'll love you right out of this world. And I did. And it wasn't just loving him out of the world. He wanted me at a certain point to learn that the Tibetan teachings for the Buddhist, he wanted to die as a Buddhist. I mean, because all he did for part of his illness was spiritual research. He really sought enlightenment, Aaron. And so imagine for the last year of his life, I am at the piano, catty corner to his bed, setting all the Buddhist teachings to music, writing him an opera of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which premieres shortly before he dies. It was so intense. It was, if you think about it, it was like my entire life on every level was happening in the intensive care unit. Everyone had died, and now Jeffrey was dying. I was writing a piece of music for him to hear as he died. Like, we had to have the stereo set up and the aria ready to go. And the aria was from the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and it was the moment of death. And she sings, "My friend, now is the moment of death. The time has come for you to start out. You are going home. You are going home. You are going home." And it was supposed to be what he heard when he was dying. And it was an exquisite recording of a beautiful black soprano singing like a goddess. And on the morning he died, he started breathing funny, and I was supposed to get him. I'm sorry, I'm upset, but there was a drug and every time you gave it, it was like waking the dead. I forget, it was one of those cortisone, but that morning he was literally sitting on me, facing me and breathing funny. And I was trying to put the pill in his mouth, and he wouldn't take it. And his mother was sleeping in the other room. And I said, "Yvonne," and she came to the door, and she just said, "He's going." What? And I wasn't gonna like push him off my lap and go set up the stereo. So I just sang it to him, and he died in my arms, you know. And I say in the book, and it but it's really the truth. It felt like he breathed himself into me. And I became at that point myself and Jeffrey. And it's very strange because I became obsessed with the writer William Maxwell, and I wrote him a letter, and that's what he wrote. He said, some griefs take 5 years to heal. And he said, that's the way it is with most griefs. But he said, some griefs are so painful and so difficult that instead of letting go of the person, we fold them into ourselves, becoming henceforth ourselves and the other. And he said, that is what I believe you did with Jeffrey. And that's what he did with his mother. That's why all those books like So Long, See You Tomorrow, and They Came Like Swallows, it's William Maxwell becoming his mother and himself. And so until Jeffrey died, Aaron, there was a word in the English language, and the word was grief. I had no idea what that word meant. I had no idea how violent it was. I had no idea how disfiguring it was, how it was an atom bomb at your life, and you had to figure out how you were going to get through the rest of your life knowing what that was. Because yes, all of my friends and people I love died of AIDS, but until Jeffrey, grief was incremental. But then when he died, it was Hiroshima. It was like, I did not know how I was going to get through the next minute. And I cried for 5 years straight. I was crazy. I think people, when they're grieving, should be put in like hospitals for at least 2 years, until it's so not respected in our culture how big and intense it is. I mean, Lucy, our dog, died in December, and it was like it tore the scab off the wound of Jeffrey's grief. Like, I was completely crippled. And so who I was before Jeffrey and then after, I just didn't know. It was like a foreign country that I hadn't been to until I visited. And then I just didn't want to talk to anyone that didn't know that country. It was like nobody else made sense to me. I sought out many things. One thing I sought out was poets, and I also sought out landscape. I somehow ended up in the American West because what I felt could only be mirrored in a landscape that north, south, east, or west, you couldn't see anything for miles. Like, it was, I needed space to express what I was feeling, space that was endless. It was really unbelievable. And it was a fever. And I guess you can tell even now, the fever continues. You know, you don't get over it. You just include it. I mean, you know, there's that parable about there was an architectural dig, and like one of the oldest pots that was ever unearthed cracked. And because of the value of the pot, instead of putting it together with glue, they put it together with gold so that its cracks glistened and shimmered. And I'm pretty sure Mark Doty tells that story in Heaven's Coast, which is his chronicle of grief after his lover Wally died. And it's a great metaphor because I'll never be Ricky before Jeffrey again. I am Ricky, and my cracks glisten and shimmer. And maybe they get brighter every year because, as we all know, every year of your life, something to refresh that grief happens, and you just have more and more and more pain. And that is not without joy, but the pain is intense, and every loss takes you back. But I also know you can't even live life without that.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. My guest is the composer, Ricky Ian Gordon. We'll be back after this.
You struggle for days over a problem you cannot solve. And then, while you're in the shower, the answer comes to you.
there's something about the unconscious that it can come up with something that is very pure, very beautiful.
Plumbing the mysteries of inspiration. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR. Monday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, author Mac Barnett and illustrator and writer John Klassen, frequent collaborators on popular children's books. Barnett's newest is for adults. It's called Make Believe, on telling stories to children. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures, here on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, this afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and I'm talking with the composer, Ricky Ian Gordon, who's known for, among other things, Grapes of Wrath, Orpheus and Eurydice 27, and many other compositions. Ricky, we were talking there about the death of your partner, Jeffrey, and the immense grief that you felt in the wake of his death. One person who knows and understands that landscape is the contemporary poet Marie Howe. She's the author of What the Living Do, which is both a collection of poetry and one of the poems in that collection. Tell me how you came across this poem.
So when Jeffrey died, my friend Michael Klein, he was really helping me at the time. He was telling me stuff to read. And he told me to read this book Mark Doty had written called Heaven's Coast about the death of his lover, Wally. When I read it, I was like, I need to know him. Somehow I got Mark's number. I called him and said, I'm coming to Provincetown this summer and I need to be your friend. You need to be friends with me. And he was like, okay. And I went to Provincetown and he lived at 19 Pearl Street. And for one summer, he and I and Paul Lisicki, who was his lover at the time, became friends. But I also met other writers, and one of them was Marie Howe. There was a very famous bookstore on Commercial Street. And Michael Klein took me into that bookstore and said, you got to see this poem. I don't know if you know Michael. That's how he told you got to see this poem. And so he showed me Marie's poem, What the Living Do. And I read it in the bookstore and I was frozen. So much so, Aaron, I had to memorize the poem. And of course, I became really close with Marie, who was there in Provincetown with us that summer. We would all go to AA meetings in the morning every day. And I only say that because Michael and Marie are public about their recovery. But so, well, Do you want me to say the poem? I don't even have to read it. I have it memorized. I'll just say it. Okay? So we just need to say that Marie's brother Johnny died of AIDS, and it took her 8 years to write this book, which is, at first it's about childhood, then it's about Johnny's illness, and then it's about life after Johnny. So the penultimate poem is What the Living Do. So the poem goes, Johnny, the kitchen sink has been clogged for days. Some utensil probably fell down there, and the Drano won't work, but smells dangerous. And the crusty dishes have piled up waiting for the plumber I still haven't called. This is the everyday we spoke of. It's winter again. The sky's a deep, headstrong blue, and the sunlight pours through the open living room window because the heat's on too high in here and I can't turn it off. For weeks now, driving or dropping a bag of groceries in the street, the bag breaking, I've been thinking, this is what the living do. And yesterday, hurrying along those wobbly bricks in the Cambridge sidewalk, spilling my coffee down my wrist and sleeve, I thought it again and again later while buying a hairbrush. This is it. parking, slamming the car door shut in the cold. What you called that yearning, what you finally gave up. We want the spring to come and the winter to pass. We want whoever to call or not call, a letter, a kiss. We want more and more and then more of it. But there are moments walking when I catch a glimpse of myself in the window glass, say the window of the corner video store, and I'm gripped with a cherishing so deep for my own blowing hair, chapped face, or unbuttoned coat that I'm speechless. I am living. I remember you.
Wow. Incredible, Ricky. Thank you for reading that poem by Marie Howe, What the Living Do. That sense of talking to her brother, John, who died of AIDS at the age of 28, in that soft, slightly chiding voice, how the sink is clogged, the dishes have piled up. Something about the smallness, the unglamorousness of the imagery makes it unbearably poignant. We feel that we're sitting in the room with Marie. How do you describe this poem to someone who hasn't encountered it?
Well, what Marie gets in the way that she has basically boiled life after death, grief down to a stock, is the quotidian that life goes on and we still have to park and slam the car door shut and pour the coffee down our sleeve and walk along the wobbly bricks. And you have to still get by. You either kill yourself or you still keep going. But in everything, in living, you remember that person and they become everything. They become your unbuttoned coat, your blowing hair, and everything becomes more poignant. Everything becomes heartbreaking and beautiful and ugly and stupid and a waste of time because now you know something you didn't know before. You know how sad life can be. I mean, it's that thing, it's James Agee, but who can ever tell the sorrow of living on this earth, you know? And that is what Marie somehow captures in this poem, but she doesn't glorify anything. It's just like, and I'm thinking about you. This is what life is now. It just continues. The world didn't stop, you know? And it's just so poignant to me. And, you know, you'll see, but when I set it to music, which of course I did, the image I had in my head when I set it to music, Aaron, was hurrying along those wobbly bricks in the Cambridge sidewalk, because that's a theme in Marie's poetry, how we hurry through our lives. And then if you think about it, where are we hurrying to? We're hurrying to our graves. Like, where do we think we're going? And you know, just to say that in the performance I wanted you to hear of the song, it's recorded by Rebecca Luker, who was a big Broadway star. Rebecca got ALS and died a few years ago. She was like the swan of Broadway with the most exquisite voice. The last thing you could ever think is that this exquisite creature would get that horrible disease and take her out of the world that way. And it did. And before she died, she recorded this song and I orchestrated it for her. And I remember Marie was really knocked out by the recording. And I think it's because Rebecca just sounds like she's talking.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and I'm talking with Ricky Ian Gordon. We're talking about one of his favorite poems, What the Living Do, by Marie Howe. Ricky, you asked there, where are we hurrying to? I want to turn that question around to you because I get a sense that posterity has often meant something very important to you. I don't know if you feel you spend a lot of your life hurrying to a destination, but I do get a sense that it's important to you to leave behind a body of work that counts for something.
Yes, it's true. I'm not sure It's the healthiest impulse. But there is a therapist, Karen Horney, and she wrote a book called Neurosis and Human Growth. And she talks about something called revenge glory. And I, unfortunately, because I feel like I was tortured when I was a child, feel a sense that I need to leave something behind because it's a little bit embroiled in I'll show you. And of course, I have no need to show anyone anymore. I have already, for what it's worth, eclipsed all those people who beat the out of me when I was little and called me names, and all those critics who caused me and artists so much pain. I revel in knowing that we will wrap fish or dog poop in their words, but my music and my poetry and the works of people like me will live on. And as Leonard Bernstein said, he has never in his life seen a statue of a critic. And why should I be so sensitive to criticism, Aaron? Because my number one wound is being made fun of and beat up and having no recourse when I was a child. The only recourse I have ever had is my talent, my wit, my intelligence. So I'm sort of caught in the whirlwind of that.
I want to go back to Marie Howe and her poem, What the Living Do. So many poets have written about AIDS. John Ashbery, Tom Gunn, we've referenced Mark Doty. I often think of the famous quote by Theodor Adorno that writing poetry after Auschwitz was barbaric. But I think what Howe and these other poets show us is that often poetry is the best way to write about grief and trauma. And I wonder if you've given much thought to what makes poetry such a unique vehicle or container, to use a term you used earlier, for bereavement.
Because if a poem is good, it's because it says in this many words what some people said in millions of words. Do you know what I mean? I always like Langston Hughes, his poem Luck. It's four lines. Sometimes a crumb falls from the tables of joy. Sometimes a bone is flung. To some people, love is given. To others, only heaven. I mean, what more is there to say? I mean, Angels in America starts with one line from Stanley Kunitz. In a murderous time, the heart breaks and breaks, and it lives by breaking. That line inspired that play. You know, that 9-hour play. And that is what poetry is. Poetry, for people who get it, has the ability to order a disordered life, a disordered mind, a disordered world. You know, I hate when people say Sylvia Plath's poetry killed her. Sylvia Plath's poetry kept her alive until she decided to die, but it didn't kill her. It kept her alive. It was her lifeline.
Ricky, you turned What the Living Do into a composition, and we're going to play out the show with that. But I'm curious about the process of turning any written text into a composition, into a score. Most famously, perhaps, John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, which is a monumental work.
Okay, well, for something like the Grapes of Wrath, first of all, just psychologically, you have to break it down. For me, architecturally, I have to think it's stone upon stone. Because if I just think of creating the Empire State Building, it's overwhelming. So I have to think I'm making a building. And what I do with a story the size of the Grapes of Wrath is I enter it where it has the most heat for me. And once I start creating from that place, say I have four stones, and each one of them feels solid enough to contain the universe of the piece, I start building the piece motifically by these themes that come about because I have picked the moment when Ma Jode has to say goodbye to all the possessions the family has accrued, when Tom Jode first gets out of prison, when Casey, the deposed preacher, is sitting there singing about a naked tree wasted in the sun, when The whole chorus sings about the last time there was rain. You start getting into the story moment by moment, and as notes accrue, a building starts taking shape. And also, just to say that before you write a piece as big as The Grapes of Wrath, my experience is like a shadow is pressing against my back. And that shadow contains the sort of feeling, the sound universe that the opera is going to have. Not necessarily the notes, but the feeling of the piece. And as soon as I put my hands on a piano, my hands start expressing that universe that has been pushing at me to come into being. The same way like when Stravinsky said, I am the vessel through which passed La Sacra, which is the Rite of Spring. But with a poem like What the Living Do, I had that poem memorized. And because it was living inside of me, it was marinating in me. And by the time I made a gesture on behalf of that poem, a musical gesture that could feel organic and that could feel honest, because what you don't want to do, Aaron, is you don't want to spoil the poem. You know, a lot of composers have set text to music in a way that obscured the text. And so I know a lot of poets are often upset when they hear their poems set to music. I didn't want Marie to feel that way. I wanted her to feel like her poem was a jewel in my setting of it. And so it came to me that the gesture was hurrying along those wobbly bricks in the Cambridge sidewalk. And when I first put my hands down, wait. That was the gesture. The gesture was that hurrying along those wobbly bricks. And when you hear the song, you'll hear how the whole thing grows out of that gesture of hurrying along those wobbly bricks.
I love a guest who is mindful enough to bring their own keyboard with them.
It's just here. I didn't have to bring it. I'm sitting at my piano.
Ricky, there is so much more to talk about, but we've run out of time. I'm going to ask only if you would imagine for a moment converting this memoir into an opera. Would that be possible for you?
You know, I wrote a musical called Sycamore Trees, which was about my life and my family. And not only has it been recorded, but it is hopefully being released soon. And I'm also writing an autobiographical piece for the Fourth Wall Ensemble. So I feel like it might be that for the rest of my life, I'm going to be turning this book into music. And I guess in a way that's fine because I still have plenty to say, Aaron.
I have no doubt of it whatsoever. Ricky, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
I felt the same way, Aaron.
Wonderful. We're gonna play out this show with your composition, What the Living Do, based on the poem by Marie Howe. We've been talking about Seeing Through, a Chronicle of Sex, Drugs, and Opera by my guest, Ricky Ian Gordon, published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux, and What the Living Do by Marie Howe, published by Norton. My thanks, as always, to my producer, Ilya Meritz, and sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood. Shelf Life is a production of Grand Journal and One Gram Books in collaboration with Radio Catskill. And if you like the show, you can find plenty more on Apple and Spotify. While you're there, why not give us a 5-star rating? It helps others find the show.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Neversink General Store, featuring catering for parties, meetings, and weddings, gourmet deli, pizzeria, and groceries inside a gas station. NeversinkGeneralStore.com, and from listeners like you.
New Mexico's Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham led her state to some remarkable firsts.
The first state to provide child care at no cost, to have universal child care. How are you paying for it?
We didn't just do it overnight, so we did a series of investments.
As her final term comes to an end, we'll talk with the governor about how states are changing American lives for the better when the federal government won't. That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill. At Morning Edition from NPR News, we just ask the question.
Is that statement true?
Get to the point with NPR every weekday morning.
Weekday mornings starting at 5 on Radio Catskill.